Welcome to a special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. We're going to call it The Abstract. It's going to be a semi-regular reoccurring episode that we'll be doing here, or a different format, where myself, Coach Jonathan Lee, and then also Trainer Road Sarah Laverty will be going over research that we've been digging into recently. Sarah, can you introduce yourself really quick? People probably have seen you on Instagram and TikTok or on YouTube. If you aren't subscribed to us on those channels, go do it right now. You're missing out on fantastic content from Sarah, Ivy, and myself as well, but particularly from Sarah and Ivy. And Sarah, maybe you can explain your background in terms of your sporting background and your educational background so then people can get a good point of reference for who you are.
Yeah, I am a runner. I'm from Scotland. I came to the US to run track and field and cross country. And I have been here now for the last 7 years. And I studied exercise and sports science at the University of New Mexico, where I ran, and Western Colorado University. And now I have the pleasure of working for Trainer Road.
Awesome. Yeah, we love having you, Sarah. Today, we're going to talk about some research because we're always digging into research and looking at the latest stuff, solving personal curiosities, but really above all, just trying to find out how to get faster. The first topic, Sarah, that you've been looking into recently has been nicotine. We should probably describe why we're going into nicotine because people are hearing it and probably thinking like, you're promoting cigarettes, and that's not what we're doing here. It's just, it's been rising in popularity recently. For some reason, sport and nicotine have been more in the public discussion, right?
Yeah, we've been hearing it on a lot of different channels and kind of through word of mouth as well, which has been interesting. It's not a banned substance, but there seems to be some still hush around it.
A lot of stigma around nicotine, for sure.
I think, understandably,
justifiably. We need to be very clear here. We are not talking about like smoking cigarettes and chewing tobacco and advocating for that. We're simply looking into why are people mentioning this and why are we hearing that pro cyclists are using this? Is it safe to use? And that's what's driving us to look into this. So we figured we'd share some observations with y'all on a controversial topic.
Yeah, definitely. So we wanted to look at what is happening and why is there an interest in nicotine? What does the research say about nicotine on exercise performance? And what does the research say about why is nicotine having those impacts on exercise performance? I wanted to look at the research as a whole. So I went in and dug around and I saw that there was a systematic review published in 2017 that looked at, up until that point, they gathered all of the research that was applicable to this question. What impact is nicotine having on exercise performance and why? They found 30 studies, 6 of which were looking at the impact of nicotine on exercise performance, and then the other 24 were looking at the impact on physiological parameters, which might help us understand those impacts on exercise performance. What did they find? Out of the 6 exercise performance studies, they found that there were 2 outcomes that saw positive impacts from nicotine use. One of which was in cycling, and that was after 7 milligrams of nicotine ingested, they saw an increased time to exhaustion. 7 milligrams is a lot of nicotine. When I have experimented before, I have felt side effects at just 2 milligrams of nicotine. So I cannot imagine taking 7 milligrams of nicotine.
For a point of reference too, I think a cigarette has around 10 grams of nicotine, or milligrams of nicotine, not grams, of nicotine.
Yes, yeah, so I'm a baby.
Yeah, and we're not talking about, and I know that I'm using that as a common reference, but this isn't like in the studies, I don't think that they had a single person like smoke a cigarette and then do something, right? Like how was it administered?
No, yeah, that's a great point. It was all of these studies had non-smoking forms of nicotine ingestion. So that would be like gum or sniffing or transdermal patches. So patches that are on your skin and you absorb them into your bloodstream through your skin. And each is important to recognize that each of these different forms of nicotine will also be absorbed or into your system at different rates. But there isn't enough research at the moment to separate the impacts of those different administration methods. So in this research, they included all of those administration types and all different doses. They do mention what those were, but it's the differing effects might be related to the administration method and the dose. Yeah. So yeah, when we come back to, we'll come back to that in once we try to understand the results. But coming back to the results themselves, there was one study that was improved exercise performance in cycling, and then the other one was improved force production, effectively strength performance, and that was just after 2 milligrams of nicotine. And if we try to understand why we might see those improved performance, those results after nicotine use, the researchers postulated that there's likely an increase in sympathetic nervous system response after taking nicotine. And this is, we're all familiar with, this is the increased, the flight or fight response, as it's commonly referred to. And we see various impacts on our body with that. It's increased heart rate, which will ultimately lead to an increased cardiac output and therefore oxygen, blood and oxygen to our muscles. And then we also will see a redistribution of blood, so that there's more blood going to our muscles and less going to, say, our gut and our skin, non-essential organs for when we're in this sympathetic state. And then with regards to the improved force production or strength, the researchers thought that previous studies have shown that an increased sympathetic nervous system response is associated with increased adrenaline and are related to most likely help with this improved strength. We have 2 out of 6 outcomes showing, or 2 out of 6 studies showing positive results. But we also see that there's no effect of nicotine in 3 outcomes, one of which is endurance. The interesting point about this study was that they reported side effects after 8 milligrams of nicotine. So similar to the previous study, but there were, the other studies didn't report side effects, which is, given the strong effect that nicotine has on our bodies, it seems like a crucial part to understand how.
For sure.
Yeah, I think of it similarly to caffeine, is that there are obviously lots of ergogenic effects of caffeine, but if we go too far, it can really do a number on us and interfere with our performance. It's likely that the side effects reported in this study counteracted the positive effects that we saw in the previous study with this endurance outcome. The other studies that saw no effect were measures of anaerobic performance and looking at using 4 milligrams of nicotine and 8 milligrams of nicotine. This is interesting because, in contrast, when we look at what studies saw negative impacts of nicotine, they were all anaerobic outcomes, which I think if we go back to understanding the mechanisms behind why we might see an effect on performance, if the primary mechanism is increased blood flow or to our muscles, it is understandable that we would, even if it's minuscule, we might see an effect on endurance performance. Whereas if we get a minuscule increase in blood flow, we probably wouldn't see a significant effect on anaerobic performance.
Sure.
And therefore, it comes down to more likely to have the side effects are more likely to outweigh those positive effects. So there were negative effects on Wingate testing. So average and peak power after using 2 milligrams of gum, 4 milligrams of gum, and the other one was 4 milligrams of gum as well. Mm. So how do we make sense of these mixed results would be the question. And yeah, I think it's too early to say. We don't have enough research looking at optimal dose, optimal administration, or even understanding how these impact us in different ways. And as we discussed before, nicotine doesn't come without consequences. It is a drug and it is highly addictive. And if we're this goes for any supplement. If there are negative impacts of it, if there's like consistently showing negative impacts, then it doesn't seem, we don't want to risk, or we don't want to mess with a highly addictive substance if there's no clear reason or clear evidence for us to use it.
The cost-benefit ratio or risk profile is bad, right? What is, you're facing something that could be truly damaging to you and difficult to drop, and the potential upside is low, potential downside. And I should say potential upside is low and also low in likelihood. Potential downside is high and higher in likelihood. So that's not, not beneficial.
Yes, exactly.
This is so interesting because this represents like the tricky issue of looking at single studies versus looking at systematic reviews. And I don't think that you can look at one or the other, Sarah. Like you have to look at the individual studies, but you also have to look at the systematic reviews and multiple of those when you can, because that does a better job of representing the body of research. Because it's easy to just see one study and just think, bam, that's the outcome, right, and that will be the outcome for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when like we said, the dose and the administration are so inconsistent, it's even difficult to understand the impacts of those when we zoom out and look at them as a whole. When we are looking at one study and it says positive results and we try and transfer that into our lives, it's not directly applicable unless we understand how it basically is having an impact on us.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we move into sodium bicarbonate, or is there anything else that we want to cover on the nicotine side of things?
No, I think that's it. Other than I wouldn't be, like we discussed, Jonathan, before, I wouldn't be surprised if nicotine does, after we understand it a little bit better, is it something that's going to be in our supplements at some point soon? Potentially.
Yeah, but who's going to make that move first?
I think, or it could be banned one way or the other. But yeah, I think it's before that happens, we need to understand the nuances of it more.
Yeah. I know nutrition companies are always looking for the latest thing, like they've added in nootropics and lots of other things, like recently, like Science and Sport has into their gels, and they're always looking for whatever the next thing is. Nicotine just comes with so much baggage, rightfully so, that I would not be surprised if nobody does, but at the same time, I also wouldn't be surprised if somebody does do it. It would just be a really bold move.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it'd be really tough. Speaking of shaky results, sodium bicarbonate, that's one I looked into recently. And if you're watching this now, go to YouTube and check out our video where I went fully in depth into sodium bicarbonate, and I broke it down in a very simple, easy way to check out. It's a really fun video. Check it out. We'll link it down below here. Within that, I talked about the body of research that exists on whether sodium bicarbonate improves performance, because I've been seeing these articles recently that, like, in some of them, I wonder, they sure seem like advertorial to me, but they might not be. I don't know. But they're like, one of them was even saying it's not banned by WADA yet. And if it continues, if it provides so much crazy performance improvement, we wouldn't be surprised if it's banned. And I was like, wow, those are really bold statements. And I started looking into the research on it. We've all heard about cyclists, like with the hour record in particular, taking in spoonfuls of baking soda, whether they just spoon it into their mouth or whether they mix it in a bottle, which is more common. And they drink that, and they drink it. Usually it's somewhere between 90 minutes before a race, 60 to 90 minutes before whatever the effort is. And that hopefully gives them enough time to pass the gastric distress that's caused by taking this in. And then hopefully they can perform and get the benefits from it. But the whole theory, and you can check out the video for more on this, but is that it's a lactate buffer. And there's some really surprising things in terms of how lactate works, what causes the burn in our muscles, everything else that you need to watch in that video. And it explains it really succinctly. Within this though, we looked at the research, and I won't give you the spoiler in terms of how it works, but we did talk about testing in-house. So I want to take advantage of this time to talk about the testing we did in-house. It was with 3 employees here. I was one of those employees. We had 2 males, 1 female. They were well-trained athletes, and weight was between 61 to 85 kilograms, or 135 to 187 pounds. And FTP was between 190 and 295. Watt kg was between 3.1 and 4.2 watts per kilogram. This is not by any means clinical research, published studies, anything else like that. We just did our own experiments. Okay. And I want to caveat that, so nobody thinks that we're trying to be our own lab over here. It's definitely not the case. What we did is we basically had 2 different tests. The first test was done with all 3 subjects. And that was a graduated ramp test. You started with 5 minutes at 40% FTP. And then after that, what we had is 3 minute steps that just stepped up every 3 minutes, 10% in FTP. And then we basically at each step measured obviously power. We also measured heart rate, RPE, and blood lactate. RPE was just self-reported on a 1 to 10 scale. And what we found with all three of us, and that's the first test, and I'll talk about the second test after this, but in the first test, we found for all three of us that there was no meaningful change for power at a given RPE. So as the steps went up, power and RPE were effectively the same. And the way that we did this, I should step back, is we had people take the test as a control first. And then after that, a week later, they took the same test, but instead we gave them Martens sodium bicarbonate product beforehand. It was adjusted for like the recommended dosage for each person based on their weight, as Martens suggests. They aren't clear in terms of how much sodium bicarbonate you are getting with that, but it seems to be on the low side in terms of what's recommended, because studies recommend taking in 200 milligrams or 200 to 300 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. And some studies don't show any difference until you step up in terms of lactate buffering. So keep that in mind, that they don't state exactly how many milligrams you're getting. Ideally, they would be calculating that, but when I weighed it out in terms of the little sodium bicarbonate tablets, they were lower than that. But they may be using something special. I don't know exactly the composition of the tablets that they're using. It may be different, maybe more concentrated in some way. Who knows? With that in mind, so those are the two tests that they did. We controlled nutrition leading up to it the day before. It was exactly the same. Training status was also the same all throughout. It wasn't like somebody went from 3 to 6 watts per kilo and we're training at the same FTP though the whole time. So all that was the same. So again, power, no difference. Heart rate, it was slightly lower when athletes took bicarbonate, but slightly. We're talking on a measure of 1 to 2%. So that's really not a significant difference in terms of change of heart rate. Interestingly, lactate was slightly higher for 2 out of the 3 subjects, but it was significantly lower for me. And RPE, there was no meaningful difference, and I'll get into the lactate in just a bit here, but for RPE, this is really interesting too. No meaningful difference, like every step along the way was graded roughly the same. It was like if you graph them, they're very similar. And I'll show that graph on screen now. But here's the interesting thing. 2 out of the 3 subjects, the ones that weren't me, they both reported the fact that even though their RPE was the same, they felt like their legs didn't have as much burn in them. And we talk about this, like a lot of you have written in questions, like why on some days do I feel like my heart and lungs are giving up, or like my cardiorespiratory system or cardiovascular system's giving up versus my muscles giving up. And both of them reported the fact that their muscles felt less burn. Interestingly, like during the test, they took it 90 minutes before, and none of them, we weren't reminding them like, this is the bicarbonate test. It could just be placebo effect why they felt less burn, or it could be the fact. I didn't experience that. I felt zero difference. But back to lactate, here's the interesting thing. So I notoriously have really high lactate. We've covered this before on the podcast. I think in a VO2 max test, I reached somewhere over 15, and then that's much higher. And typically where people's LT1 is, where they might be somewhere around 4 millimoles, I'm typically somewhere around 7 to 8, and then it goes up. And this is, I don't eat refined sugars very often at all. This is not a situation where I'm just like downing a bunch of sugar and going in, and that's why my lactate's high. This is giving enough like 2 to 3 hours before we do some sort of test like this. But here's the interesting thing. So there was slightly elevated levels of lactate for 2 of the subjects. And I'll explain why I think this is the case in a bit. But for me, it was lower, and not slightly lower, but it was substantially lower. So basically what we did is we looked, and with this test, we just went stepping up until you went 1 step past where we visualized that inflection point that you hit LT2. So basically like where your lactate really spikes up and goes really high. And that's after that, we called it on this ramping test. And in the first test, I reached 8.6 millimoles, whereas the other subjects reached somewhere under 6 millimoles. So just around there. So I was significantly higher. For the other subjects afterward, one of them went from 6.0 to 6.5 when they took sodium bicarbonate. And then the other subject went from 5.7 to 6.1. So they had elevated lactate, whereas I went from 8.6 down to 7. So I went substantially lower with that. I thought it was maybe an error with the test, but if you look every step along the way, trends consistently, the tests were taken effectively. And so I redid this test and I got the same results within plus or minus tenths. So we're quite close. And then here's the interesting thing is that later on I did a separate test, and it was a test of, and we used like one of the workouts that we have, Gendarme plus 8. It's 3 by 15 minutes of 30 30s at 140% FTP. So these are like high, like anaerobic efforts where you're 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. And I tested that and I got up to 18.6 for my lactate, which is crazy high. And for those that watch the YouTube video, we put in, I have to see if somebody said 18.6 yet, because I had them guess what it might be. And if so, I'll send the winner a swag pack. But that was 18.6. I took bicarb and did it again, 15.1, which curiously is about the same 19% reduction in lactate from the ramp test. So why the different results? This is backed up by the research. There are responders, non-responders, and adverse responders when you look at the research, meaning that for some people, sodium bicarbonate helps, some people it does not. And they're talking about performance improvements like TTE or power output, and that's how they're measuring it. And they still, some people didn't see, saw performance detriment, no difference or improvement. So it's backed up by the research. But here's my theory, and people, I would love it, and especially like researchers, if you're listening to this, I'd love to hear this. Maybe sodium bicarbonate is not as much like a lactate buffer and more it's a lactate optimizer, or perhaps it has an optimizing effect. Perhaps there's some sort of, quote, optimal level of lactate that the body can operate at. And as a result, what sodium bicarbonate does is it helps us achieve some sort of a balance. Because in my case, you would assume that since I'm producing a huge amount of lactate, that it might also cause me to produce more like the rest, but it doesn't. It seems to drop me closer and get me closer to what like average or expected values would be. The way that it works is that basically sodium bicarbonate enters your bloodstream through some sort of painful way that is going to involve a lot of gas and feel like you're going to vomit and throw up and have to use the restroom. And it gets into your bloodstream. And once it's into your bloodstream, when lactate enters the bloodstream, it's basically exhaust from our muscles. It's used. And then once it's used, or I should say it's put out like a car into our bloodstream, out into the air. And when it enters our bloodstream, we can actually end up reusing that lactate as fuel. But when that happens, we break it down and there's this remainder to the equation and it's hydrogen, and our blood becomes a hydrogen rich environment, which makes it acidic. We assume that's what causes the burn, but we don't really effectively know exactly what causes the burn, but that's the assumption. But with that in mind, when sodium bicarbonate's in there, it's effectively able to absorb some of those hydrogen ions. And when it does, that's what makes your blood less acidic. And that's what helps with this sort of thing. So it's really curious, but that's what we did internally. It backs up the research. The body of research isn't fully conclusive that it works, but it does seem that in the majority of cases, there is minor performance improvement. And we're talking like 2 to 3%. So if you haven't yet checked out that video, it's got some really interesting stuff in it. And yeah, but that's what we found out on that one.
Jonathan, did you all experience similar GI issues, or was that different between you?
Yeah. So I tried, so we all took in the Martem product, and then separately without tests, I took in just sodium bicarbonate mixed into a bottle. And I tried spooning it in and I quit. Like after just, I was so disgusted. It was terrible, but I tried mixing it into a bottle too. The Martem one was way less disturbing to my gut. It was way easier to take in anecdotally for me.
Okay.
That being said, for the other two subjects, they were gagging and wanting to throw up taking in the Martem because of the texture and consistency. It's not pleasant. It's similar to their gels. And a lot of people have said like that gel feels like snot because it's like jello that was like strained or something and like passed like maybe watered down. It's more watered down than that, but it has like a subtle sweet flavor, but then it has those little sodium bicarb tablets in there that are like really salty chunks. Okay. It's really not a pleasant thing, at least for most people. I was able to get it down without issue, but afterward I still felt gut distress for sure.
Okay.
Lots of burping and just discomfort in general.
Right.
So yeah, it's not comfortable to take in regardless of the administration method, but the Martem stuff seems substantially better. Once again, whether that's because it's just less bicarbonate or whether it's because their hydrogel technology is at work and actually doing something there, I don't know. I don't have a way to validate that.
Yeah. So given the nastiness of it, is it, do you think would you recommend experimenting with it, doing certain workouts or certain types of races, or do you just not recommend it at all?
Yeah, it'd have to be the right type of workout too. Definitely not races. Don't experiment with it there. Don't use it for your low intensity stuff. The research has proven, it hasn't found that it helps with low intensity workouts. Right. It also hasn't found that it helps with long workouts, like the effects wear off rather quickly. So if you have something like unbound gravel, for example, that starts hard, but it's a really long day, it might help you for the very beginning, but then after that it won't. And in commonly reported cases, just anecdotally speaking, if you go onto our YouTube video, you can see a lot of people that have shared how they've taken it. After taking it, if it's during a long ride, they have a temporary, if there is benefit, it's temporary. Then after that, they feel a detriment, but your mileage may vary there. So I would be looking at using it if it's like a really particularly a tricky VO2 workout or a hard threshold workout or anaerobic workout. And if you were nervous about the outcome and you wanted to be able to like perform really well or something, but even then I'd argue that unless you're going to use this in racing, it wouldn't be a good idea. And using it in racing is just tough. I have like a theory too, that I would love, I don't think the researchers did this, but I would love for them to also, for each subject, to rate their rate of discomfort or their amount of discomfort on like a 1 to 10 scale. And if you could cross-reference how much gut discomfort they experienced with their performance outcomes as well, I have a theory that you would find that those that experienced more gut discomfort also didn't perform as well. And perhaps those with less discomfort were able to perform better because their head was in a better space, their gut was in a better space, and perhaps their body was too. So and maybe that's the trick with Martin stuff, is that it's not as painful to the gut. So maybe it can work better.
Yeah. And maybe why the dosing was less than you saw in the studies potentially as well.
Potentially. It could be on par. I don't know. Okay. Just when measured the little tablets, it didn't add up to what I thought it would be. But once again, they could be doing something that I don't understand there. I'm not an expert on that. But anyways, it's quite interesting. And it's a marginal gain that we hear a lot about, but I don't think that it's a marginal gain to keep in mind. The cost is just outrageous if you're doing the Martin product, like insane. It's like after tax and shipping, I think it was like $20 a serving. So over $20 a serving. Yeah, really expensive and probably not worth it. When if you're not sleeping 8 hours a night, you can probably get a whole lot more benefit from doing that or just fueling your workouts. Or doing proper training. Anyways, yeah, that's what I found. Sarah, how about energy availability? Let's talk about that topic. That was another study you looked into.
Yeah, so energy availability is energy intake minus energy output. So how much food we consume versus how much calories we burn. And typically this is measured over the course of 24 hours, but our bodies respond in real time to changes in how much we burn and the food we consume. So even just hormonally, it's the response is very acute. So researchers more recently have been interested in when our energy availability, even if the energy across the 24-hour period is equivalent, what impact does our hour by hour energy availability have on our markers of health or performance? Typically, energy deficiency or low energy availability is flagged by low resting metabolic rate. So in this study we're looking at by Torst, Veit and colleagues, they took a group of men, I think there was around 31 men, and they separated them into those who had a suppressed resting metabolic rate and those with a normal resting metabolic rate, and looked at their diets to see if there was any impact on how they distributed their calories throughout the day on their resting metabolic rate. And what they found was really interesting. There was no difference between the groups in how much they ate or how many calories they consumed over the course of those 24 hours. But when looking at the hour by hour energy availability, those with a suppressed metabolic rate or resting metabolic rate, they had more time in energy deficits exceeding 400 calories. They had larger single hour energy deficits, and those larger single hour energy deficits were associated with higher cortisol.
Putting that into like practical situations, does that basically means like going longer between meals or perhaps even skipping meals? Is that that's what would cause these shorter term energy deficits that they found themselves in?
Yeah. And interestingly, I'm actually not a study we're going to really touch on today, but I'm also looking at this other study that looks at the impact of a high calorie breakfast versus a high calorie dinner in the context. And they're like looking at how that impacts our hunger in society throughout the day. I think it would be, for example, that, yeah, it could be that you have a smaller breakfast, then you train, and then you catch up on calories at night. So you've gone throughout the whole day in a long calorie deficit, but then you do make up for it at the end of the day. That would be, you might end up in calorie deficits that are exceeding 400 calories. So you're not matching that energy input to the energy output throughout the course of the day. I think it just highlights that it isn't necessarily the total calories that we consume, obviously. And we should really be paying attention to fueling our work, fueling before, after, making sure that there's just this steady stream of nutrients fueling our day, because that allows our bodies to perform on or work on all cylinders. Everything's firing. I did look at another study that looked, it was a very similar study. One of the authors was involved in both studies, and it was in female athletes. And in a similar way, they separated the elite female, I think they were runners, by having menstrual dysfunction or those with a healthy menstrual cycle. Again, another marker of low energy availability, and very similar results. Those who had menstrual dysfunction, they went longer periods of time in an energy deficit. They had lower estrogen, and although there was no differences in the total calories consumed.
How interesting. So this, like, the take-home message that I'm getting from this one is that skipping meals has detrimental effects, which could include affecting a woman's menstrual cycle. But also it could affect very much the resting metabolic rate that I have going into things. And that's like such a focal point for a lot of athletes, is that athletes are always talking about power to weight and optimizing that. And if you have a low resting metabolic rate, it's going to be a lot tougher to have optimal body composition. But above all, it's going to make it really tough to have optimal performance too, because if you are not processing a lot of fuel to be able to build and repair your muscles, then you're just simply not going to be able to build and repair as much. It's a tricky thing. So that's, and I feel like the assumption is that you get that sort of change in resting metabolic rate after like long periods of like crash dieting or something, and it affects it. But it sounds like it's way more flexible and reactive than that to like rapid things, which is that's astounding to me. You know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting you mentioned the body composition. When I was looking at this research, there was mentions of, particularly in female athletes, I didn't see this being discussed in male athletes as much, but even when the energy, so in this study, as I said, the energy balance was similar between both conditions, but even when the energy input doesn't match the energy output, we don't actually see women, their body composition doesn't change that significantly, suggesting that the adaptive response is that your resting metabolic rate decreases and therefore matches the suppressed or low energy availability. So if we get into this cycle of not matching, or even, so not matching it on an hourly, hour by hour basis, but also in the long term, then it's basically, we're just down-regulating all of the systems in our body and causing us to perform at a lower, or our whole body to perform at a lower level.
Kind of crazy, huh? Related to this, a study that I've been looking into, queued off from Dr. Podlagar. Do you mind if I jump into this one?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it ties into this pretty well. It's called Effect of Different Carbohydrate Intakes Within 24 Hours After Glycogen Depletion on Muscle Glycogen Recovery in Japanese Endurance Athletes by Nama Motonaga et al. In 2022. This study is basically looking at, it had eight, and they were male collegiate endurance athletes, and they all had roughly around a 56 VO2 max, so they're like fit, trained people. And it basically had them do, they did a glycogen depletion exercise of 90 minutes. And then after that 90 minutes, what they did is they gave them one of three different options for a recovery meal that then they would ingest within the 24 hours thereafter. That recovery meal would contain either 5 grams per kilogram of body mass, or sorry, of 5 grams per kilogram of carbohydrate And that kilogram breakdown is per total body mass. It isn't lean mass or anything. So to give people like some, they did either 5 grams per kilogram, 7 grams per kilogram, or 10 grams per kilogram. And giving people a point of reference, I'm 68 kilograms. So basically what that comes down to is if I was taking in 5 grams per kilogram, that would be 340 grams, which would be 7.6 cups of rice or 1,360 calories. Yeah. Which somebody's hearing that and probably thinking, oh my gosh, that's a lot. But here's the crazy thing. What they did is afterward, they tested muscle glycogen levels to see if they were replenishing muscle glycogen levels thereafter. And they did this by looking at muscle tissue and using a lot, multiple different measures themselves to be able to like look like with, I think there's some sort of spectrometer analysis, but then also with just measuring the muscle tissue itself. With 5 grams per kilogram, they did not replenish glycogen stores within 24 hours. However, with 10 grams per kilogram, they did. Putting that in context, that means that if I took in 7 grams per kilogram at 68 kilograms or 150 pounds, I would have to take in 476 grams of carbs, which would roughly be 10.6 cups of rice. There's probably more efficient ways to get it in than cups of rice. About 1900 calories. But if I took in 10 grams per kilogram, that's 680 grams or 15.1 cups of rice or 2720 calories just in carbohydrate that I would be taking in. But keep in mind, if I'm doing an exercise, and actually I'm going to pull up a spreadsheet to be able to guide me on this one because it always shocks me when I think about this. If I do something and let's just say I go out and I average 250 watts for a ride and I do that 250 watts for the space of 2 hours, I've already burned in that just in that time period right there, 1800 kilojoules that I've burned if I do 250 watts for that. So yeah, it makes sense that I would be looking at hopefully replenishing with 680 kilojoules of carbohydrates. I would need to do more than that. So it's crazy when you think about it. But all that said, what this basically points us to is that with our recovery drinks, like we always talk about recovery drinks and recovery nutrition. And we think that you just need to eat normal, but then like afterward have a recovery shake. But to your point, Sarah, we need to really keep our eye on this like these windows of low energy availability that we could find ourselves in that get brought on by these caloric deficits. If you find yourself in that spot, oftentimes you're like, just make sure it's 4 to 1, like 4 parts carbs and 1 part protein. And that's like what we need to be able to take in. While that ratio is important to take into account, we should also be looking at the overall carbohydrate amount. We should be feeling at least 7 grams per kilogram. Somewhere between 7 to 10 grams per kilogram is what this study suggests to achieve muscle glycogen repletion or reestablishment within a 24-hour period. If you're training every day, every other day, or if you're just carrying on through life, that's a really important thing. So then that way you aren't depleted coming into your subsequent workouts. And that's the situation. So if you find yourself being an athlete that really struggles as you get into week 3 of a loading phase, which it'll always be tough, but if you find yourself like, I feel great for the first week of training. Then the second week it gets harder. Third week it gets harder. Maybe you're finding yourself in a spot where you're not replenishing glycogen stores effectively. And in our mind, we're probably doing that because we want to lose weight. And in our mind, we're like, well, if I deplete myself, we'll be good. But what we're finding here is that based on Sarah's research here into this, into what she was talking about, that actually can lower your resting metabolic rate. And then on top of that, it makes it so that you don't have the necessary resources on board within your muscles to be able to continue this. And keep in mind, this is just after a 90-minute exercise where they were aiming to deplete, which is a high intensity for 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. A lot of us do that all the time. And so you could easily deplete glycogen very quickly and then get yourself to a point where it's not topped off. So 7 to 10 grams per kilogram of carbs is what we want to aim for. Crazy.
Yeah. And I would say to me, that's an intimidating amount of carbs to to consume. But for sure. I think just trying it and seeing the impact that it has on your full day, like what you're saying, like those acute responses, you'll notice that you do feel a lot better throughout the day. You're able to do more and your resting metabolic rate is higher. You're burning more calories just through your daily activities, and you'll notice that you don't feel like you have to make up for it at the end of the day. You don't need to catch up. So I think it's having trust in your body and understanding that this is what your body needs, and then experiencing those benefits really is helpful to reinforce and get over that fear or intimidation of consuming that many calories.
And my thought too, with if you're like, man, that's a lot of calories to take in, look at what you're taking in and try to remove fat from it from a macro perspective, because fat brings in so many calories per gram of fat. So if you are going to be taking in more calories through carbohydrate, reduce the amount of fat you're taking in. Make sure that you're keeping protein at around 2 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight is typically what's recommended, Sarah. Yeah, so if you're doing that, then focus on those two and then just try to reduce the fat, and then that'll help you hit calorie goals if you are measuring or doing that sort of thing. But yeah, that could be helpful. Last one, Sarah, let's talk about returning to training after a concussion. This is one that you've been looking into it. This is
a little bit self-serviced. It was teenagers who had suffered a concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury within 4 to 16 weeks. And they looked at these teenagers to see, they're asking whether aerobic exercise was helpful or harmful in the recovery from prolonged symptoms from a concussion. They separated the participants into two groups. One group were doing a stretching program, and the other group were completing aerobic exercise 5 to 6 days a week. They measured the, to determine, they individualized these, the aerobic exercise program, by having them complete a ramp test of sorts. It's not a ramp test. Not a ramp
terrible.
Test. Yeah. Don't do a ramp test if you've just had a concussion, but it's in a ramp test in the sense that it was increasing in intensity, and they were trying to find the point at which symptoms were exacerbated. At the point that symptoms were exacerbated, they took note of the if they didn't experience symptoms, then it was 30 minutes long, so they would cut it off at 30 minutes. If they went beyond, or if they were able to complete those 30 minutes, they weren't involved in the study, because you've not got post-concussion syndrome if you're able to do 30 minutes of increasing intensity. The intensity started at, it was, I think it was at an aerobic intensity, and it would gradually increase till probably threshold intensity. And for anyone who has experienced a concussion, threshold intensity is just not possible if you're still experiencing symptoms. So they found the intensity where each participant would experience symptoms, or the symptoms were exacerbated, and they took 80%. So they found that duration, they took 80% of that duration, found the corresponding intensity level for that, and they would have them complete that 5 to 6 days a week. So say if I was completing the test and I got to 20 minutes before experiencing symptoms, I think 80% of that, if I've done my math correct, is 16 minutes. At the 16 minute mark, say if I was 150 watts, I would do 16 minutes at 150 watts, 5 to 6 days a week.
So really then, not that tough. That's easy stuff.
No, not at all. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's at a level...
In short.
Yes, exactly. And I think the important point to reinforce here is that if you go beyond the intensity where you... Or if you even reach the intensity that symptoms are exacerbated, that just has the complete opposite effect that you're looking for. You do not want to exacerbate symptoms at this stage, at any stage of your recovery from a concussion. When they had their participants, they did their respective, either the stretching condition or the aerobic exercise for 5 to 6 days a week, and compared the recovery between the groups at the end of 6 weeks. And interestingly, I think it was more than, if I just check the details here, it was, so 6 out of 12 teenagers who completed the aerobic exercise training were completely resolved, they resolved their symptoms at the end of 6 weeks and no longer had to continue in this rehabilitation program. In contrast, in the stretching group, only one person in that group, 1 out of 14, where it was fully recovered. So it is a significant difference. And I think it's, on one hand, it's encouraging because us cyclists and endurance athletes are terrible at
resting. I know where you're going with this.
Yeah. But then on the other hand, it's also, I did get a concussion a couple of months ago, and to be told that only 16 minutes of riding my bike for 5 to 6 days a week is not a lot of training. So you're not, it's not training. You're not doing this with the intention of getting fitter. It's with the intention of getting better so that you can ultimately get back to training and get fitter.
That's a really good takeaway. That should be the perspective that we all have. We should not be worrying about fitness. We should be worrying about regaining health. Mm-hmm. And the good news is the bike can be a great tool for that. It can be stationary, locked into a trainer. It's safe. Mm-hmm. You're not going to crash in that circumstance.
Right, exactly.
You're not out running where you could fall or do anything else. And you're also, I love the thing about the trainer in particular for this is the fact that you don't get far away. So you don't find yourself in a situation where if you are noticing side effects, you aren't like, I've got to do whatever I've already done. I have to do that just to get back home.
Yeah.
Get on and the far side of a hard climb or something. And then you have that hard climb to do. It'd be terrible. But it's a good setup for it.
And I think it's really, I think discipline here is like, I've definitely struggled with this in the last couple of months, and having the discipline to stop is because you think you're fine up until you're not fine. Is the really tricky part of this, but and it will continuously hopefully get better.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Sarah. We'll share all links to the research that we shared down below. Clearly there's no published research on what we do with lactate individually here. So there is no research on that, but what I will do is share all of the studies. Actually, I won't do that. I'll just share the link to the video. You can find the video within that video description, a link to every study that I researched for that sodium bicarbonate one. Sarah will drop down the links that she has from the studies we've discussed here. And I'll share that one that I was talking about on how many carbs you need after you train as well. So the takeaways that I'm getting from this. So if you're going to be, if you've experienced a concussion, we'll work backwards. If you've experienced a concussion, a great way to be able to come back is give yourself 2 weeks of not doing anything. After 2 weeks, then at that point you start to do this, you can give this a shot and see how it works after you consult with your doctor to see if this is what your doctor would suggest for you. And in that case, it's to just start at a very low intensity and slowly step up until you experience symptoms. You shouldn't be getting to threshold. And wherever you experience those symptoms, take 80% of whatever that power is and then use that and just do that for 16 minutes a day. And then do that for somewhere around 5 days a week. See how you feel. That should allow your body and perhaps aid your body in recovering from the concussion. Would you say that's accurate, Sarah?
Yep. Perfect.
Cool. Okay. And then on carbs, 7 to 10 grams per kilograms of carbs is what you should be taking in post exercise. So that way, if you've been doing like hard glycogen depleting sort of stuff, which once again, like 90 minutes of intense exercise will do that. And that will help you avoid caloric deficits, which we have found in like these like inter-day caloric deficits, these holes that you have where you put yourself into a more profound one. And as Sarah mentioned, those sort of things can affect our resting metabolic rate in an adverse way. If we skip meals or run ourselves into a hole, it could even affect your menstrual cycle as well. And then going backward from that, sodium bicarbonate can make you faster, but it's expensive, it's gross, and it's not likely to give you a huge benefit. And finally, nicotine, the results are mixed, and boy, there's a huge amount of risk with taking in something like that. So even though we might hear whispers and increasing whispers of pro athletes using this, maybe it's not the best thing to do. So something to keep in mind. I think that covers it. Science-backed takeaways that will hopefully make us faster. So thanks, Sarah. For everybody that, of course, everybody that wants to follow Sarah, we'll put her Instagram down below as well. Follow Trainer Road. You'll be able to see Sarah's content that she's putting out. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube. You can share this podcast if you found it helpful with friends. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks, everybody. Take care.